This is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Buddy Holly was a seminal figure in the development of rock and roll. Emerging in the mid-1950s, the West Texan had an innovative approach to music, characterized by his distinctive vocal style, songwriting, pioneering use of the Fender Stratocaster, and his groundbreaking use of the recording studio. Tragically, the 22-year-old Holly died in a plane crash on February 3, 1959. Holly's death created a void in the early days of rock and in the music industry, but it was filled with a new burst of creativity with talent and quality that holds up even today. But this has been largely ignored or even looked down on by music critics. In his book, Rock and Roll in Kennedy's America, A Cultural History of the Early 1960s, Richard Aquella argues that this was an important era in rock and roll, not only for the music that it produced, but also for what it tells us about living in America at that time, with the rise of youth culture and the emerging diversification of the nation.
It seems that that period, in many ways, and I'm talking the years from 1960 through and including 1963, things changed dramatically starting in 64 after Kennedy's assassination. Changed dramatically for the country as well as for the music. And one of the things that has happened over the decades, I think, is that music from 1960 to 1963 has basically become sort of a forgotten chapter in rock and roll history. It gets sandwiched in between the coming of rock and roll in the 1950s. Think of pioneers like Elvis Presley, Fats Domino, Chuck Berry. Lots of great stars there in the 1950s. And then come the period of the Beatles starting in 1964 and beyond. And even though the music was excellent in the early 60s, it's become forgotten in some ways, at least for many people. For people who lived through that time period, they still remember those songs, or if they're experts in music, they know those songs. But for the general population, that's not the case. That many people have forgotten some of those things. And one of the things that has contributed to that, remember the song by Don McLean, American Pie? It comes out in 1971.
Bye, bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. And them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing this'll be the day that I die. This'll be the day that I die. They were singing, bye, bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing, this'll be the day that I die.
That major hit basically is going to help establish this notion of the day the music died, that it picks up on the death of Buddy Holly, Ritchie Valens, and the Big Bopper in a tragic plane crash in a cornfield in Iowa during a winter party dance tour. And that's what McLean zeroes in on. And that becomes sort of a shorthand that the music dies along with Buddy Holly and all these early rock and rollers, and it's not resuscitated until the Beatles arrive on the scene, and then all of a sudden it's great again. And built into that notion that the music of the early 60s wasn't as good, didn't deserve to be covered as much, some historians have referred to it as a period of schlock rock that was just pop music, wasn't really rock and roll. And what I wanted to do in this book is basically say, wait a second, this is an important era in terms of the artists who are there, as far as also what they tell us about the times. And that's one of the things that makes this book different, I think, that for me, as an historian, it's extremely important not so much to talk about whether or not it was quality music. You know, if I was a music critic, I would be maybe saying this song's better than that song. That's not my purpose. My purpose is to take a look at the entire landscape. And what do these songs tell you about life in the early 1960s?
In February 1961, Del Shannon had a breakout number one hit.
Is the music actually overall excellent music, but it's just as historically important as the stuff that goes back in the 1950s or beyond 1964. If I could just add one other thing to that, I can remember a friend of mine who's I've known this guy for decades, and he's always been into music. And when he heard I was writing this book in the early 60s, he said, "What are you talking about? Why are you wasting your time? That's not rock and roll in the early 60s. It's just pop music." And I kind of did a double take. And I said, wait a second. And then I start naming some of the performers, you know, big name performers. Ray Charles hits it big during that time period. All the Motown artists are beginning to make their appearance in the early 60s. Brenda Lee in country rock during that time period. Dion, formerly of Dion and the Belmonts, is cranking out hit after hit in the early 1960s. And when I start mentioning specific names, my friend said, "Oh yeah, I guess you're right. There was good music." And that's what I'm trying to get at here, basically. That what we're dealing with is trying to put the music back into the spotlight so people understand that this was an extremely innovative chapter in rock and roll history, and a very important one as well.
The book is Rock and Roll in Kennedy's America, A Cultural History of the Early 1960s, published in 2022 by Johns Hopkins University Press. It won the Independent Publishers Book Award for Popular Culture. Let's go to break with one of the big hits of 1960, the Everly Brothers' Kathy's Clown. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're discussing the book Rock and Roll in Kennedy's America, A Cultural History of the Early 1960s with the author Richard Acuella. Here is a 1962 number one hit song recorded by Gene Chandler.
As I walk through this world, nothing can stop the Duke of Earth. And you are my girl, and no one can hurt you. Oh no, yes I.
When people say the music died, there is this impression that after the death of Buddy Holly, there was this time period when a lot of novelty songs charted really well. And I'm thinking of things like Alley Oop, 1960, Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny, Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, Running Bear, Speedy Gonzales, songs like that, which are, you know, novelty.
Yeah, that's true. I would not disagree with that. Thing is, that's always been a tradition in terms of popular music in general, any form of popular music, really. You'll hear things like that going on. And those songs are there. There's no question about it. And like I said, though, they also tell you something about the times in terms of what's going on. With each one of those songs you mentioned, I pick up a lot of on all those in the book, basically. And even songs like Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, which you mentioned, can be tied to some of the changing trends, fashion trends that come into the bikini during that time period. Sexual mores are beginning to change during that time period. I mean, you see the roots being planted here for major changes later on.
In the early part of this era, after the death of Buddy Holly to John F. Kennedy's assassination, it does seem like this is an age of rock and roll innocence in many ways. And it's also there were some novelty songs by, you know, like Dominique and Kuyu Sakamoto. So there were some foreign elements there, but mainly this was an American lane, pretty much. It was just very distilled American before 1964.
Exactly. In fact, that's extremely important in terms of trying to put the music into the context, because one of the things that stands out, and most people nowadays probably don't realize this because the music now is so global in so many different ways. But back then, in the 1950s, in the early 1960s, rock and roll was an American form of music. Probably somewhere between 95% and 99% of all of the artists making the rock and roll charts during that time period were born and raised in the United States. If someone, in fact, came from England or came from Japan or came from somewhere else, most American teenagers wanted nothing to do about that because they thought this isn't really rock and roll. That what you're talking about is it's a foreign imitation, but it's not the real thing. And that plugs into this entire notion of American hegemony following World War II, that the United States, and don't forget, rock and roll was born in the midst of the Cold War. And this is just one thing that's going to reflect that. I mean, this idea that only Americans can sing rock and roll tells you something about the attitudes of not just teenagers during that time period, but all of America as well. I mean, you're talking about a time period coming out of World War II, let's say from 1945 onward, where for the next 20 or so years, American hegemony throughout the world is going to be unrivaled in some ways. That the United States was the number one power when it came to military strength, number one power economically, number one power politically, as far as the United States and this notion of democracy, and we are the leader of the free world, was the notion during that time period. And rock and roll is plugging into all of that kind of stuff during these years. I mean, one of the things that people look at is you don't have really political music, rock music, until the late 1960s and beyond. Then things start getting political. And the reality is, that's just not true. This music of the early 60s and rock and roll of the 1950s is political in a more subtle way. I mean, you're not going to find too many songs that go out there and explicitly talk about politics. Once in a while, you get one. But for the most part, what you're talking about is these songs are going to be more implicit that they will support the era's Cold War culture, the dominant culture during those years. Rock and roll, in other words, is part of that consensus behavior.
That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. All day long they're saying, ugh.
Sam Cooke recorded Chain Gang, what, 1960?
Yes.
That's a political song.
Oh, yeah, it certainly is in terms of that. I mean, well, you're finding some of these songs during this time period are picking up on that. Sam Cooke, Change Is Gonna Come. He writes that in 1963 and doesn't release it for a couple of years because he thought the song was far too political in that sense. It's not until things begin to change that he even comes out with it and releases it as a B-side of a record. That's what's fascinating about this in some ways.
But he wrote it in December of 1963 when all the turmoil started to happen.
Yeah.
Then I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me please. But he whines up knocking me back down on my knees. Lord, there have been times that I thought I couldn't last for long, but now I think I'm able to carry on. It's been a long time coming, but I know change gonna come. Oh, yes it will.
It's that post-war culture that begins to change, that America's changing in subtle ways in the 50s and throughout the early 60s and beyond. Obviously, it gets even more explicit in terms of things going on. But one of the big changes that occurs, and one of the reasons why I wanted to write about this particular time period in the early 1960s, is in the fall of 1960, the vanguard of the baby boom generation hits high school. They enter high school the same year that John F. Kennedy is elected to the presidency. And then throughout their high school years, you know, 61, 62, and 63, as Kennedy and his presidency are beginning to take root and changes are beginning to occur throughout the country, this baby boom generation is essentially going to play a big role in that. And this generation, for various reasons I talk about in the book, thinks it's the a unique generation, that there's never been another generation like this in some ways. Now, arguably, every generation thinks that, right? But the baby boom generation had sheer numbers to back up that statement, that what you are talking about is every single year from 1960 onward, every time you have a graduating class of seniors going on, leaving high school, the new freshman class is going to be larger. And as a result, what you're talking about is by the time it's over with, there are millions more of these baby boomers there listening as a potential market to this music. And record sales are going to go up accordingly because now the market is larger. And now, rather than the traditional pop styles of the 1950s, even traditional pop artists sometimes, Steve Lawrence comes to mind here, and his wife Edie Gourmet, begin trying to record songs that are going to appeal to these teenagers in high school. So, I mean, things are changing quite rapidly.
We got to hit a break, but let's check out the 1963 hit single by a 13-year-old Stevie Wonder. Fingertips was recorded during a Motortown Revue performance at the Regal Theater in Chicago. And when we come back, more Motown on The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Uh-huh.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're having a discussion with cultural historian Richard Akela about his book, Rock and Roll in Kennedy's America, a cultural history of the early 1960s. This song was the first hit for Motown Records. Barrett Strong recorded it in 1959.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the
In 1959, Berry Gordy starts Motown Records. It'll eventually become the most successful Black-owned and operated company in American history, with over 600 million records sold. 1961, Please Mr. Postman becomes the first number one pop hit released on Motown, and it is a sensation. How big is Motown during this era?
Very big. In fact, the Marvelettes with Please Mr. Postman gives them their first number one hit, and from that point onward they're picking up momentum. During the early 1960s on Motown, not only do you have girl groups like the Marvelettes, and Martha and the Vandellas are another one, their first hit, Heat Wave, coming in 1963, but you also have the coming of Stevie Wonder during those years. You have the coming of the Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. I mean, Mary Wells is a superstar in the early 1960s. So there are lots of Black artists who are making it big. And behind the scenes at Motown, you're talking about not just Black artists performing, but you're talking about almost the entire operation is African-Americans, from Berry Gordy Jr. all the way down, including in most parts secretaries, producers, songwriters, everyone working within the building. There are a couple exceptions of that, people like Barney Ailes, who's going to be on the business side of it. But there are going to be African-Americans operating that company. It's a perfect example of what people were talking about during this time period on a political level, and that is economic Black power, not to be confused with other forms of Black power that come in by the late 1960s. But what they were talking about for many civil rights individuals, including Martin Luther King Jr., that they were pushing for African-Americans to get more involved, owning businesses and getting involved in that way. Berry Gordy Jr. epitomizes that during those years.
And soul music also begins to develop in 1961 with hits with Sam Cooke, James Brown, Solomon Burke. Stand By Me becomes a number one R&B hit, Benny King.
Yeah, that's true. And one of the things that's going on here too, David, I think that's important to understand, is in 1960, the African-American population of the United States was approximately 11%. Okay, that's in 1960. Within a year or two, it rises up to 30% of the hits on the charts are being done by African Americans. And by the end of 1963, it's up to 36% of all of the hits on the charts are recorded by African American artists. And that's coming at a time where the population, like I said, is about 11%. So what's happening there is very similar to what's going on throughout the rest of America. And that is, there are more opportunities for African Americans in terms of employment and all sorts of other things. Civil rights is beginning to pick up momentum. The Civil Rights Act doesn't come until after John F. Kennedy's death, but culminating in 1963 with that March on Washington, there's this sense of optimism that change is coming. Now, I don't want to overdo that because it doesn't happen all at once, obviously. Yeah. And to this day, we still haven't gotten there in terms of that kind of society people were talking about back then. But all of these are indications that changes are occurring during these years.
And it's evident in the music industry.
Sure. And what you have is, not only are there more Black artists out there, and let that sink in for a second, because what that means is now white teenagers across the country are more likely to be listening to songs done by African-American artists, bringing those records home, playing albums sometimes in their homes. And frequently what we're talking about, and particularly in the South, with segregation during the early 1960s, is here are artist records being played in homes of white segregationists in some ways. And the parents sometimes had no idea that was going on. And I find it more than coincidental, and I talk about this in the book, that if you look at the early album covers, whether it's the Shirelles or whether it's the Marvelettes or other Motown groups during that time period, the company, even though it was a Black company, did not put a photograph of the artist on the cover. It wasn't just a coincidence. In fact, Shirley Owens of the Shirelles, the lead singer of the Shirelles, talked about that, and I mentioned this in the book. And what Shirley Owens says is that what you have is the owner of the record company explained to the Shirelles, we're not going to put your photo on the cover because that's going to hurt sales. And Shirley Owens said, we understood that. We didn't necessarily like it, but we understood why that was happening.
I met him on a Monday and my heart stood still. They do run, 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 they do run, run. Somebody told me that his name was Bill. They do run, 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 they do run, run. Yes, my heart stood still. Yes, his name was Bill. And when he walked me home, they do run, run, run.
Why so many girl groups, the Ronettes, I want to mention as well.
Okay.
Why is that sound grabbing hold of people, and particularly at this time?
Well, let me put that into context, because I talk about the coming of girl groups during that time period, because they really take off after 1960. There are girl groups prior to that, obviously. I mean, you could go back to the 1930s and 40s, and you find groups like the Andrews Sisters in the 1940s. By the 1950s, the McGuire Sisters, the Lennon Sisters are also big during those years. The Bobettes are coming along during the years of the 1950s, a Black girl group. And the Chantels are another one during that time period. The Ponytails are a white group during the 1950s singing rock and roll. So it's not like girl groups start in the early 60s. That's a long tradition that you've had in some ways in terms of pop music. What's going to be different here, though, by the early 1960s, and to answer your question, why it seems to take off, I think there are a couple reasons for that. At the vanguard of all of that will be the Shirelles, who get their start in the late 1950s. I Met Him on a Sunday was the first hit in 1958. So, I mean, they're just starting during those years. But what's going to rocket them to the stratosphere in some ways in terms of popularity is in 1960. And in 1961, they're going to have two hit records. The most important of the two is going to be Will You Love Me Tomorrow, written by Carol King and Jerry Goffin.
Tonight you're mine completely. You give your love so sweetly. Tonight the light of love is in your eyes. But will you love me tomorrow? Is this a lasting treasure? Or just a
that song is going to be a really interesting song in some ways because there's a rhythm and blues feel to it in terms of the Shirelles and their sound, but that's mixed in with a white pop sound that's coming out of the Brill Building during those years. Luther Dixon, who is their producer and an African American, is the one who produces that record. He adds violins to it and adds all sorts of other little touches to it. And it's a more polished sound. And I think that's going to be one of the reasons for the popularity of the Shirelles. The other reason is the Shirelles themselves, their sound is, and I don't mean this in a negative way, it was an unsophisticated, untrained sound. In some ways, these were not polished singers. These are four African-American girls who come out of high school and they begin having these hit records. They're about the same age as their listeners who are listening to these records. And the songs that they are singing are geared to those teenage interests, whether they're white teenagers or black teenagers or any other teenagers in this country. The Shirelles are singing about dancing. They're singing about romance. They're even singing about sex, right? With songs like Will You Love Me Tomorrow? And that one, basically the entire song is dealing with this notion of this girl and her boyfriend. And she's worried about what's going to happen that night. And she's asking him several times, will you still love me tomorrow? Basically, if we go all the way tonight. Same thing with their previous song, Tonight's the Night, that this was going to happen tonight. Now, teenagers, again, we're talking about this first wave of baby boomers that's just hitting high school during those years. And that was hot stuff as far as many teenagers were concerned. And they really enjoyed the sound. They enjoyed the Shirelles watching what's going on. And you got to put it in the context that this is at the exact moment where, because of the civil rights movement and because of all of the civil rights marches that are going on, more and more Americans are being exposed to African-American culture. And here you have groups coming along, whether it's the Shirelles or the Chiffons is another group with the same kind of sound, or whether it's the girl groups coming out of Motown, that what they are offering audiences are songs that are extremely well done, very well produced, excellent material in terms of the songs that are being written, and it gives audiences a taste of African-American culture. Now, I say taste because those sounds that I just mentioned, whether it's Motown or whether it's the Shirelles and some of these other girl groups during that time period, weren't as authentic as maybe you mentioned early soul music. Aretha Franklin is just getting started during this time period, and she's not really hitting the charts until later on. But what you're looking at is all of the music scene is beginning to change, reflecting changes going on in America as a whole.
Let's go to break with the Ronettes, fronted by Veronica Yvette Greenfield, who later became Ronnie Spector when she entered into an abusive marriage with the record's producer and later convicted murderer, Phil Spector. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. In 1962, teen idol Ricky Nelson got meta with this song.
Some people call me a teenage idol. Some people say they envy me. I guess they got no way of knowing how lonesome I can be. I need somebody to be my baby. Someone to tell my troubles to. I've got no time to ever find her, 'cause I'm just passing through. I travel around.
The contrasted girl groups, we had the male teen idols, and the criticism today of the teen idols is that their presentation was flat and thin. You know, we have names like Bobby V, Del Shannon, Dion. There's a lot more there, it seems like. Ricky Nelson, of course. How should we be looking back on the teen idols of the early 1960s?
What you're looking at here is the notion of authenticity and how people look at what's authentic and what is not authentic. And the image of teen idols, I think the general image of teen idols now is that these people, in singling out individuals like Frankie Avalon, Fabian, Bobby Rydell, all of whom came out of Philadelphia and made numerous appearances on American Bandstand during that time period, that the attitude was it was contrived, that this was not authentic music. Now, that's what critics are saying, and it really picks up later on. I say, you know, after 1963, for certain, it becomes much more devastating in terms of the critical reviews of some of those teen idols. But if you look at what's going on here with those artists, think of some of the people you just named, in terms of Dion, in terms of Del Shannon, Bobby V, I would also throw into that one. With all three of those people, they were doing excellent music during that time period. Some of rock and roll's greatest hits come from people like, you know, Dion doing songs like Run Around Sue.
Here's my story, it's sad but true. It's about a girl that I once knew. She took my love and ran around with every single guy in town.
Hey, hey,
whoa, 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 la, 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 la. Away from a run around Sue. I miss the lips and the smile on her face, the touch of her hand and that girl's warm embrace. So if you don't wanna cry like I do, I keep away from a run around Sue. Whoa, whoa.
I mean, that's solid rock and roll. Or you take a look at Del Shannon, Runaway, one of the greatest hits in rock and roll history, according to most critics, is another example of this. And he is going to be portrayed as a teen idol. Gene Pitney, you didn't mention him, but Pitney is another one of these guys with a fabulous voice. And some of the songs that he's cranking out during this period, like I'm Gonna Be Strong, are excellent. I mean, this is excellent music during these years.
There goes my baby. Everly Brothers seem like another area that people, I think, would find a lot there to listen to if they've never heard them before. They would they wouldn't know that they was from 70 years ago.
Yeah, you're right. And I think, David, what that also shows is once people start saying, well, what about this one? What about this one? That's when you begin to see how great the music was during those years. I mean, some excellent stuff was being produced. And what I tried to do in the book, too, is try to get at the backstory behind what's going on with some of these things, too. Like the song Louie Louie comes to mind here. The story behind that song, when that first comes out in 1963, people don't know the lyrics because it's all garbled. And it comes right on the heels of John F. Kennedy's assassination. And people are looking for conspiracies everywhere. And the FBI goes, like, trying to find out what the song means. They wind up listening to the record repeatedly at 33 speed, at 45 speed, at 78 speed. And they just throw their hands up and say, we have no idea what these guys were saying. It's a fascinating tale about what goes on that shows how the music's plugging into the time, specifically after Kennedy's assassination.
So after Kennedy's assassination, the theme in your book lays out that rock and roll took a different turn. The Beatles arrive 1964, and they dominate. People who were hit makers before that couldn't buy a hit. They couldn't get arrested. So how does the Kennedy assassination play into that? Is it the trauma, the shock, the new idea that we're in a new era, we need new music? What happened?
Kennedy is the youngest elected president in American history, 43 years old when he's elected. He becomes, if I can use the phrase, he becomes a rock star in himself in terms of how the media is going to react to him in the early 1960s. Kennedy seemed invulnerable. I mean, he personified the optimism of the era. He personified what was going to happen with these new frontiers and all these different areas. All of a sudden, that comes crashing down. How do you explain that? Particularly to this younger generation, those kids in high school and younger, how do you explain to them that here's the United States with God on our side, and all of a sudden, this president, larger than life, is shot down in the streets of Dallas. We're not talking about some kind of evolutionary change that occurs in rock and roll music. We're talking about something sudden that is going to happen here. If you take a look at some of the big names on the rock and roll charts, Fats Domino during the early 1960s had 29 top 30 hits. After 1963, zero. Brenda Lee, 19 hits on the top 40 charts in the early 60s, only four after 1963. Bobby Rydell, 19 top 40 hits, zero after 1963. Something happened there, and it happened suddenly, that youth culture was under attack, basically, not just from Kennedy's assassination, but prior to that, there had been a series of things, most recently the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, just a year before. And prior to that, the Vienna Summit, Bay of Pigs, and we came pretty close to World War III when John F. Kennedy was president of the United States. And all of these things, stress is piling on, and then comes November 22nd. And it's no wonder that all of a sudden, kids are looking for something different. They're looking for something that's going to be more, get rid of the mourning or whatever they were feeling. And it's going to basically make them more enthusiastic about life in general. It helps them forget that worry.
Now there was sort of a cultural amnesia. The Rock and Roll Hall of Fame doesn't really pay this era much credit, much attention. Do you think that will change? Do you think that we're coming to a time where we can look fresh at this time period, pre-Beatles, post-Buddy Holly's death, and discover that there was a lot of rich music produced at this time that said a lot about America?
I hope so. I'm not sure it's going to be the case in some ways. Many critics are going to say the music of the late 60s in the early 70s is much better than what you get in the 60s or even in the 50s because it becomes more political. You're going to have folk rock emerging by that time period, and that's going to make lyrics more meaningful. The music after 1964 becomes much more explicit when it's dealing with riots in the streets or when it's dealing with the war in Vietnam. So it kind of depends on a generational type thing. But I would hope that what would happen is if people start listening to these songs, they're going to understand that this is a very important chapter in rock and roll.
Richard Aquella is a cultural historian and the author of Rock and Roll in Kennedy's America, a cultural history of the early 1960s. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, and let's go out with the Beatles.